This Friday, St. Patrick's Day, the world premiere of the latest work from one of Ireland's finest composers takes place at the National Concert Hall. Sean Davies' Refuge, Concerto for Cello and Orchestra, will be staged alongside his timeless contemporary classic, The Brendan Voyage. Refuge is the culmination of Sean's long-held ambition to write a concerto for cello and orchestra, which gained extra impetus during the enforced isolation of lockdown. Cork-born cellist Sinead O'Halloran is the concert soloist who will bring the piece to life under the baton of David Brophy conducting the National Symphony Orchestra. I'm delighted to have both Sean and Sinead with me in studio this evening. Sinead has also very kindly brought along her cello with her, and Sean and Sinead, I know, have been working on little sections from the concerto that you're going to give us a flavour of it tonight, which is wonderful to even hear a bit of it ahead of Friday night's full performance. To get to play Sinead a concerto by a contemporary composer is a great thing.
Yeah.
To get to play the world premiere of a concerto by a contemporary composer, I can't think of a better adjective than great. It's a really great thing.
Yes.
But your professional relationship with Sean Davey actually goes back quite a long way, over a decade.
Yeah, I grew up playing in the National Youth Orchestra of Ireland, and we had the pleasure of touring with Sean and Rita and Liam O'Flynn, and we played the Brendan Voyage and Grania Whale, and I have such fond memories of that tour. It was really so inspiring, and I also used to listen to the Brendan Voyage as a child. In the car on our holidays. So, it's really quite surreal to...
Yeah, because you were living in Cork, but you used to go over to Kerry, which was the equivalent of the Brendan Voyage for a Cork person,
exactly,
wasn't it?
Exactly, yeah.
big trip to be made across the border.
Absolutely.
So, I suppose, Sean, were you principal cellist at that time?
I was, yes.
I would be surprised, Sean, if you can remember the specifics of any of the members of the National Youth Orchestra at that point in time.
I have a very fond and strong memory of a small, bespectacled girl who never spoke but who played the cello like a supreme being, and was always with a pencil in her hand, leaning forward and adjusting the part. And Garode Grant was conducting and just listening to every word. She was a presence. I never thought that one day we would be working together.
Yeah, on a world premiere of
it's a great completion of a circle, as it were.
Yeah, and were you principal cellist at that time? Do you remember,
yes,
Sinead?
Yeah, I was, and Sean had lots of cello solos in that part, so I remember I got to play some solos with them back then. And it was a lot of fun.
So yeah. that cello aspect of things has been something that has it been scraping at you for a long time, Sean?
I didn't know how to write for the cello really, but I always recognize it as one of the principal solo voices potentially in any piece of orchestral music. You can always depend on the cellist to play a beautiful solo. And so Sinead did. She played the solo in Grania Whale.
Yeah.
In The Death of Richard in Iron. Yes.
Yeah. So there's
I knew she had form.
there's history there, for sure. Yeah, yeah. And Sinead, then when you heard of this opportunity, Sean contacted you. Was it just a straightforward? Are you around? Would you like to?
Yeah, I think it was like 14 months ago or so. It was around Christmas 21. I remember.
Yeah.
I was doing a recording with my quartet that day, and this email came through on our break, and I was like, oh, this is very exciting. And I'm just so glad that we managed to find a date.
The space.
The funny thing is, Sinead, I found you on YouTube, and I saw you, and I saw this mature woman playing with such authority, and I thought, that can't be the same girl. It was, and it's just great. It's fantastic. And I wrote to you thinking, well, you might say, no, I'm busy, or it's not my kind of thing, but you wrote back a beautiful letter. So here we are.
Yeah, and let us get to share some of that music. But it's just wonderful that there's such a kind of a completion of a circle in some ways in the story as you both tell it there. Lockdown was a huge input in terms of the... When you hear a term, even to give a concerto a title like Refuge, Sean, it tells us something about the emotional state that you're in, that you wanted to express within this concerto.
Well, I think we all were in that same emotional state where we didn't know what was coming down the line. There was no vaccine. We were told it could arrive in maybe a year's time. we were pretty sure that not everybody was going to live through it. Not everybody, and not everybody did. And so I wrote a piece thinking this could be the last piece I ever write. And I decided to put, it's my, like my letter in a bottle. It's kind of, in a way, it's my life in this piece of music.
So you're it's your own life that you're describing in many ways.
In a way, and also there's sort of an ongoing search for identity, and hence the cello speaks with, it starts speaking in a quite a local voice, and it progresses into a more sophisticated and a stranger voice as the piece progresses.
And would you see that in some ways as a kind of a microcosm of your own journey through music?
Yeah. Yes. Yes. The music has been, for me, I think, you know, I'm 75 now, and I've never quite understood where I come from, where, you know, what is my country? My mother was English, father was Northern Irish. Spent 40 years in Wicklow. I've always been drawn to traditional music because for me that feels like home. Mm.
And indeed, we're going to hear a little section from the opening movement now. In some ways, I think I was listening to it and you were chatting to me about it beforehand, John. There's a sense here that it's the beginning of a day or it's the beginning of a life. There's a waking up moment.
Exactly, yeah. The first movement is about the cello waking up. The soloist wakes up and starts to talk to us,
yeah,
and then makes the orchestra talk back, and then then it develops into an exchange.
Obviously, we haven't got the entire orchestra in Studio 7 at the moment, but we'll get a real sense of how it moves from that waking up movement into two wonderful realizations of what sounds like very traditional music in many ways. So maybe you'd give us that little section first of all, Sinead, then, from the opening movement of Sean Davies' Refuge, Sinead O'Halloran on cello. Absolutely beautiful there, a little section, an edited section from the opening movement of Sean Davies' Refuge Concerto for Cello and Orchestra, the world premiere of which will be performed in the National Concert Hall on Friday evening by Sinead O'Halloran, who you just heard doing just the cello part for us there. And I'll ask you a little bit about that. Now, you have to ignore the fact that Sean's sitting across the room from you at this point, because it opens us in some ways in that little section that you gave us, Sinead.
Yeah.
It's the classic feel of the cello and that lovely long legato melodies that we can get from a cello is very much there, but very quickly it moves into that jig and then later on a reel, which has that real idiomatic quality to a real sense of traditional Irish music. How has Sean placed that on the instrument for you? You know, is it difficult to get that traditional sound and classical mix on the cello?
It's something that I've always wanted to do, actually. I moved to the US when I was 18, and I think I always had a love of trad, but it was really when I moved away that I realized, oh, I need more of this in my life. So that was when I kind of started experimenting with playing a bit more trad. And yeah, I think Sean's done a really good job, and it's been so nice to be pushed more in that direction and to see what are the limits of the instrument. I think Sean goes there, and I think it's great. Yeah. I think it's amazing, yeah.
And to what extent, Sean, obviously, I mean, you've done this before in terms of, particularly if we think of the Brendan Voyage, which will be performed on Friday night as well. Mark Redmond will be doing that. It's almost become, I don't know, it'll always be Liam O'Flynn's in some ways. It was beginning to become Mark's concerto at this point in time.
Yes, it is.
Yeah,
yes,
it is. But you have done this idea, and the pipes with orchestra brought up a whole different set of difficulties with the cello as a solo instrument with an orchestra. Yeah, that's more, I suppose, more the centre of the repertoire. How much did you depend on Sinead for that kind of mixing the styles of classical and trad and what the instrument could do? What kind of conversations did you have on that?
We've had pretty key conversations about the traditional feel. I mean, a lot of that is instinctive rather than figured out and put on the page. So Sinead has the instinct to play the traditional grace notes the way they should be played, which is basically without thinking about them. So that is natural to her. So that is one of the big factors that she's brought. It's a big strength she's brought to the piece.
And Sinead also mentioned that it was 14 months ago that it all started. There was time spent working together. You went down to Sean and Rita's home, and I think David Brophy, the conductor, was there,
yes,
for a period of time there as well. How important was that for you, Sinead, that
it
period?
It was really important. Yeah, I mean, I spend so much time playing music by people that I never get the chance to meet. So it's really amazing to have the chance to ask questions and to try different things and make suggestions and see, oh, does this work or what about this tempo? And yeah, and Sean has been so open to so many ideas, and it's been really amazing to have that chance. And we had a few days together in December, and it made such a difference. Mm. Yeah.
Let's hear a little bit from the second movement, if we could now. And we're into a much, I think, more of a lament feel as we head into this piece. The jig and reel of the first movement have subsided, and I think we're into a much more reflective space. Sinead O'Halloran again with another extract from Refuge, the Concerto for Cello and Orchestra of Sean Davey, that receives its world premiere on Friday evening in the National Concert Hall. I love but that particular section, Sean, I love that we were up in the higher register of the instrument, and by the end of that section we're right down in that low, you know, really emotional space that the lower notes of the cello can give. I suppose there were lots of people in your mind and around writing a lament like that.
Well, I mean, that's a movement with a spine of sadness that runs through it, but it's not entirely sad, and it brightens up after that passage, and then we return to that bit at the end. No, I wasn't thinking of particular people. It's just a lifetime, a reflection on a lifetime's experience. Yeah. You know, it's just, You work with what you've got at the time as a composer. So
I'm wondering too, in the third movement, there's another kind of quite reflective passage in here as well. And I think, do you have a story basically that goes with this third movement?
Yes, I'm eyeing the clock because I really want you to hear as much pieces.
Yeah, that's why
I got to talk really fast. So the third movement, halfway through writing the piece, I woke up with music running through my head, and I wrote it down. I woke up and turned the light on and wrote it down on a piece of paper.
How often does that happen, that you get a melody in a dream?
When you're really working hard, it can happen several times, put it that way. Not every night, fortunately. And normally you wake up in the morning, you go and check it, and it doesn't really work. It's not, you can't quite reconfigure exactly what it was you were hearing. This time I did, and I knew what the dream was about. The dream was about myself, an experience when I was five, when I was comforted by my father, and it stayed with me all my life. So there's a small phrase, small voice played by the cello, which is my voice as a five-year-old. And then there are responses when Sinead is joined by other members of the cello section, which are my father's presence through my life.
That's even as you say it, it's quite moving. Let's have a listen to the music, if you wouldn't mind, then, Sinead. wonderfully delicate phrasing and movement there in that particular section from the third movement of Sean Davies' cello concerto, Refuge. Just take the microphone back in, if you wouldn't mind there, Sinead, because I'm wondering when... I know how difficult it is for composers and writers to talk about what it is they're feeling when they write pieces, and it's really annoying when people like me ask questions like that. But when the openness and honesty with which Sean simply told us that story of his childhood and, you know, touches on his relationship with his father, for you as a player, obviously you're playing the notes on the page, but having that type of information and that, you know, getting that word directly from the composer himself, what difference does that make?
It makes such a difference. Yeah, such a difference, because I spend my life trying to decipher what composers mean and trying to come up with stories and things like that. And yeah, just having that inspiration really is really...
Yeah, and the specifics of that image in your head, I suppose, are hugely helpful to it. Yeah. And up on the higher register, as you had it there, as Sean's voice, as the little, as the 5 year old, as the 5 year old boy, were you doing something apart from up on the, were you muting it, or were you doing something in it that was gave it that kind of almost airy sound?
Yeah, I was playing a bit more like on the fingerboard of the cello, and also like a quicker vibrato, so kind of shaking.
So that gives us that kind of that delicate touch that we were hearing. I'm just going to send you straight into the fourth movement, because we had the jig and the reel in movement one. We're returning to Irish dance form in this fourth movement, but it's a slightly scarier Irish dance form that we're about to hear. And it's fading off. It continues on from there. What strikes me most about that, Sean, is the kind of, it's shifting in terms of time signatures, and it's hard to find the beat and stuff in like that in it. This was a time, given that this was written in the time of the lockdown, was the chaos and the kind of out of control nature of that very much reflected in this piece?
Yeah, I think so. I think the fourth movement is about losing control. Mm.
How frightening was that for you at the time?
We went out the gate, and there were guards stopping people and asking where did they live, and we weren't allowed to go more than 2 kilometres from our house, and you know, we all shared the experience. And you went out to the road, and it was like the plague had arrived, because it is deserted. The place was deserted, apart from the guards. It was a very strange time.
Yeah.
So it was beyond everybody's experience, really. And thanks be to God, it's over now. For now, thing. We've got another crisis now, but, you know, that was a tough time for everybody.
How in control do you need to be when you're playing, in inverted commas, out of control music, Sinead?
Well, there's a fine line, I think. Yeah, there's a fine line. Yeah, as in control as possible, but I think it's also good to embrace the feeling of chaos.
The slight chaotic.
Yeah,
yeah.
For the emotion to really come through, you also have to kind of live in that world.
And I'm guessing when the orchestra's in that adds to the feeling of chaos, Sean.
But you know, Sinead is very, very brave to do this, because she'd normally be playing at least with a pianist. And so she is very exposed doing this. She's done a brilliant job.
No, it is extraordinary that you're sharing this and that you're both sharing with us ahead of a world premiere. It's a really generous thing. The final movement, and I know this is why you were watching the clock, Sean. You were worried that I'd be squeezing the final little bit on you.
I knew you'd banish it.
So tell us a little bit about what we're thinking about as we head in.
You know the waking up tune at the beginning? Well, it returns at the end and turns into a proper melody. And so the last movement is how that tune blossoms. And it also reflects, as it were, the end of a life. ¶¶
Lovely, delicate sound at the very end on that final note. I get the sense, Sean, from you that this piece has drawn on emotions, on large emotions for you. Does it stand out in that respect in some way for you?
Yeah, it does. And I'm obviously it does because I've got tears in my eyes now.
Even as you were talking earlier, I got that sense of it. And
I
know how, you know, you're a very private man. So to share those things with us here this evening and indeed as people will hear the music on Friday night, I'm very grateful for you for doing that. By the way, is the Brendan Voyage in the first piece and then the concerto?
No, this is first.
This is first. This is first. So you'll actually get to hear the Brendan.
Exactly, I can have a party afterwards. Yeah.
So will you go up and sit beside? Well, I presume the family will be up on Friday
everyone's
night.
Everyone's coming. Yeah.
Memories of trips to Kerry.
Exactly.
Listening to the Brendan Voyage.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the plan.
Well, listen. Delighted that both of you came into us and could be here with us this evening. Really looking forward to hear. And this piece, Friday night will be the first performance. Let there be many performances after that as well. That's the world premiere of Sean Davies. Davies Refuge, Concerto for Cello and Orchestra, and the classic Brendan Voyage, all being performed at the National Concert Hall this Friday evening, St. Patrick's Day. The National Symphony Orchestra on the night will be conducted by David Brophy. Full details on nch.ie. Described as Belfast's pleasure laureate, Rosemary Jenkinson is a playwright, poet and fiction writer. Her short story collections include Catholic Boy, which was shortlisted for the EU Prize for Literature, and Lifestyle Choice 10 mg, 10 milligrams, which was shortlisted for the Edgehill Short Story Prize, and the best-selling Marching Season, published by Arlen House in 2021. Her latest book, Love in the Time of Chaos, is her sixth collection of stories, which, among other things, features love during lockdown, a reformed drug dealer burying himself alive for charity, and an intense experience in Ukraine. Stories which speak without doubt the times we are living through today. And delighted to have Rosemary Jenkinson join me on the line now. I'm not sure how much of our conversation with Sean Davy and Sinead O'Halloran you heard there, Rosemary, but in fact Sean talking about Sean Davy responding to his time during lockdown musically, you're responding to that, but we're talking about a time of chaos. I think there are several chaotic events or worrying events on your mind across the collection, Rosemary.
Yeah, I thought, Sean, of the unifying theme of our times, really, which is a combination of COVID, Brexit, cost of living crisis, and Ukraine. So it's really a conglomeration of all these issues that we're trying to, but love conquers all in the end.
So you're optimistic on that aspect of life at any rate?
Yeah, well, I think we have to be in this time because we've just come through so much. And I mean, I do love writing about contemporary Northern Ireland and the positives, but also the negatives. There's the protocol also. I've got one story in the collection, which is about the Northern Irish protocol, A Storm at the Border, suitably titled. Yeah, and in fact, I'd just written a play, Silent Trade, about human trafficking, and a wonderful thing just happened this weekend. It was Seamus O'Hara, who was in our play, just brought home the Oscar for An Irish Goodbye. So, you know, there's a lot to celebrate in these times as well.
I want to talk a little bit about the specifics of some of the stories, and we'll dip into the various themes that come out of them. I'm reading from the opening paragraph of The Crosshair, which is the opening story in the book. All the families in his street were bound with the light gag of a city that kept too many secrets. There's a sentence about we're talking about Belfast. Explain to me the situation of this young, he's a writer, in fact, or he's thinking about writing a memoir, this character of yours, Curtis. Tell us about what's on his mind and how it fits into you as a writer.
Yeah, well, I've written a memoir myself, so I know that he's a troubles memoirist. Oh. He's going back into something very traumatic in the past. And I find that even going into my own family. So I drew on those sort of experiences and what the publisher says and draws out of him. But it's also, obviously, he has a danger about coming public with certain things, because there's an issue with hidden guns in this actual happening of the past. So it's fraught with personal danger for him, but it's a need to expel the story, the narrative that he's been bottling up for years.
Don't make a show of us, his mother says. has said to him at a certain stage in life. Let us leave it at that. People can find out how that fits into the story. But don't make a show of us would have been her thoughts around him writing about this at all. To what extent does a writer from Northern Ireland have to think about don't make a show of us when he or she goes to write about anything that touches on the Troubles?
Yeah, as somebody who's sort of got burnt from that particular subject, I mean, it is very sensitive, and I think it's very much you have to talk about how it interests you in the aftermath and about how it affects contemporary people and how mentally it affects us. There are dangers in going into it, but I think it's just the importance to get shed some of these stories from the past as well. So we're kind of going through a sort of transition, really, of trying to get into the contemporary world while also bearing the past and bearing witness to that, even now, fresh witness.
And to what extent, for you, because Curtis, later on in the story, I get this sense, I think I might even be quoting here, that writing is a kind of exorcism. For Curtis, it gets stuff out. Is it that for you, or is there something else involved in your writing, or something more perhaps as well?
Well, I wouldn't say I write very much about the past or the Troubles. I mean, I'm a purely contemporary writer in many ways. I mean, I've written two stories in this that are about the past, and that's The Crosshair, and one other about a past events coming through. But usually I'm kind of more into the what is happening right now. I mean, it's Curtis as well. Curtis's adventure through life is through what is happening in his work and his love affair. And it's how he kind of exercises his past to move on. And I think we all do that in Northern Ireland, and it is part of our obsession. But there's so much more in this collection.
Absolutely.
Of modern, you know, it's in bars, I'm in pubs, I'm in, contemporary workplaces.
Yeah, you are. And I mean, I could talk about the other story, but we do want to cover more than just the theme, because yes, the Troubles are there, but the kind of the moving on from the Troubles seems to be a very important part of the stories that you tell. You also talk a lot about not just love in the time of chaos, love in the time of COVID and the love virus. Terrible need, which I think came out of your own emotional experience at that time, a terrible need just simply for, you know, we all wanted hugs around the time, didn't we? We all wanted physical contact.
Yeah, I mean, I was single, so living on my own, it was terrible. You know, I mean, I totally missed even the hug of somebody. It was the skin hunger, we called it during the time. And really, it was about breaking those two particular stories are about breaking lockdown rules to have that physical contact. Because, I mean, politicians were doing it left, right and centre. Little did we know at the time. But we morally were obligated to be Puritan. But I mean, the only way I could do it was to contact people on Tinder. So I imagine the Tinder uptake went through the roof during that time.
You're hanging the carrot you're hanging it in front of me, dangling it, and making me want to ask it. Because I will come back to how memoir and autobiography fits into the stories. But particularly in those two stories, how much do you start at an autobiographical point, and how far away do you veer from it across the stories?
Oh, yeah, well, they totally vary, because some of them are based on what people tell me. But I mean, I do take my research very seriously, and even though I don't like Tinder, I will go on for it, actually for the sake of research, to know what other people are doing. I mean, I have to put myself into the feet of other people who are suffering during COVID as well. So I think those are the stories that are really out there. And so, I mean, I do feel obligation to, but of course there's autobiography. I use my own relationships and the experiences I have and as well. So it's really, yeah, I guess a fusion.
Yeah, and I mean, I've said it in the introduction. It was Carol McGuinness who talked to you, who refers to you as Belfast's pleasure laureate. You certainly don't shy away from writing the sex scenes. What's the approach to that? I mean, because some authors, you read two lines and you think, I don't want to hear any more. But you seem to be quite comfortable to go in and describe in fine detail what's going on.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly hope people aren't going to say, I don't want to hear any more, because I enjoy it myself, and I hope that I project that enjoyment. Mm. And it's about, I approach it two ways, really, and it's to bring out the humour of the situation. There's always humour. It's the awkwardness of how you come together. And so humour is one aspect, and the other is to make it beautiful. Even the most unattractive body has its beauty. And I think it's really about mining that. It's being truthful as well. So maybe the combination of humour, elevating to beauty and honesty. I'm fascinated because each person is an individual. And particularly in that sense, you will never get one experience that is the same from another. So I think they are infinitely different. And that's probably why I'm Belfast Pleasure Laureate, because I like to explore it.
You talked about taking your research very seriously. Khaki Beach, if I might finish by talking about that particular story, it brings two people, Matt and Mirren, to Ukraine and to Kyiv. You travelled there. When were you actually there, Rosemary?
I was there twice. I was there in June and I was there at the end of September. And I was in, Kyiv and Kharkiv.
So you were there when the conflict is in full flow?
Yes, the conflict is going. But when I went to Kharkiv, they had a few weeks before the Russians had moved out of there in May, and the bombing had stopped a few weeks before. So when I was there, it was fortunately quiet, and I was able to go. You know, I mean, you go out there and you don't know from one hour to the next, can you go there? But you just take it play it by ear. Things are quiet, and you take your chance and go, and you just hope and pray to God that everything will be okay. You know, because I'm not on the front line. I mean, obviously the front line in the Donetsk is totally dangerous. There is a danger, but it isn't extreme. And I want to know the stories of there and meet the people and understand what they're going through. Yeah. So it was very important for me. And it's a source of future stories, to return.
One thing I wanted to particularly pick out in that story, it's a very vivid description you give us of the body of a Russian soldier in a tank. But you chose to tell us that story and to describe that of a Russian soldier in this situation. What was on your mind in choosing that soldier, if you like, or that side of the story to tell us?
I did have that verbatim description told to me, and it was so shocking, you know, and I knew that the person who told it to me was haunted by it. And I knew, when I wrote it's a haunting description. I think that's what aid workers do see, these the bodies. And I suppose I chose the Russian just because it is what you find in those frontline areas. So, traumatic,
It certainly was, and it's a very disturbing passage and really adds to that story. Fascinating collection. And you say future stories to come from that particular source, the Ukrainian source, Rosemary?
Definitely. I mean, there's so much going on there, and it's constantly changing place with, yeah, I mean, situation. And yeah, definitely so much more to learn from what is happening. This is the biggest war since the Second World War. It's huge. It's not just news, it's fiction as well.
Yeah, well, listen, thanks for just joining us this evening and for sharing some of your thoughts in and around that. A brace of themes involved in Rosemary's new collection, Love in the Time of Chaos, Rosemary Jenkinson, and it is published by Arlen House. Set in the near future, Extrapolations is an 8-part series telling the all-too-familiar story of humanity's ongoing struggle to offset the disastrous effects of climate change. Armed with an acclaimed writer and director and an all-star cast that includes Sienna Miller, Forest Whitaker, Edward Norton and the incomparable Meryl Streep, Extrapolations is perhaps one of the most eagerly anticipated television events of 2023. But can you make compelling drama series out of global warming? That is the question that you are going to answer this evening, Chris Watter. Good luck with it all. I suppose, let us lay out the stall here. I mean, I've mentioned some of the cast there. I've only mentioned Matthew Rhys is in there. Heather Gray, who else? Sienna Miller is in there. I mean, it's a huge cast. Tell us about the writing and directing team, because they'll always be referred to as the writers of?
The writers of Contagion. And Apple TV seems to have gone out of its way to let you know that the guy who wrote Contagion. That is true, because Contagion had a resurgence in popularity of a couple of years ago, because it is a film that was released in 2011 about a pandemic, and it's an ensemble piece. And some of the material in it, although we were fortunate enough to, at the time to be ignorant of, some of the material we now realise was so close, was so authentic, so realistic.
Scott C. Burns,
yes, he's a playwright, screenwriter, the director as well, known for his work with Steven Soderbergh. Steven Soderbergh actually made Contagion. He's also done The Informant, The Laundromat. He was involved in the Bourne films. But in Contagion, he created a world that was quite realistic, quite similar to ours. And again, it was this simple thing that a virus quickly spread, a pandemic broke out, and you have people just not really knowing what to do or how to live in a world where this virus is everywhere. And we all watched it. There was a huge surge. I think there was something like a 5,000% increase of people watching that. So now that he's working on a new series about climate change, the big question is, okay, is Scott C. Burns going to predict the future 10 or 20 years away from us now?
Well, 14 years away from us.
Yeah,
in fact,
that's true, yeah.
The first episode is set in 2037.
It is, yes.
It's quite sprawling in that there are a lot of kind of threads to the storyline. But I suppose the big one is this guy, Nick Bolton, who thinks he has the solution to everything.
He is, yeah.
And he's a capitalist. Does he like his money?
I think if you can imagine a sort of a handsomer cross between Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos. I mean, he's played by Kit Harington from Game of Thrones. Doesn't look anything like those gentlemen. But he is a tech mogul. He doesn't have any personality, but he has all the money in the world. And he might have the answer to humanity's survival, because we are looking at a planet where temperatures are increasing. The forests are on fire. New animals are extinct every day. Sea levels are rising. But he's telling, the United Nations that he might be able to help, but we know that he's only looking to profit from it all. So we see his story, we wander in and out of COP47, we go in and out of the lives of a zoologist who's trying to rescue endangered species, we wander into the life of a hotel developer and casino developer who wants to build, Sean, a casino in the Arctic, and we also wander in and out of the lives of ordinary people in extraordinary circumstances. Yeah. For instance, my favourite story, this rabbi from America who's moved to Tel Aviv and wants to stay there, says that he's needed to work there, but his father wants to bring him home, and we have this interesting story where the father's just not listening to him. So that's a kind of an interesting angle where you have people shouting about problems, but their elders just not listening because they won't be around later.
And also we have holograms of young activists speaking to the world about what needs to be done.
Yeah, so you've got your Bezos, Elon Musk characters in one corner, and then you have your Greta Thunberg characters in another, and we've got these huge holograms of people saying, when are people going to listen? The world is dying around us. So an awful lot to work with there in the first episode.
Yeah, and I was just going to say, we've only touched on the first episode, because if you told me that's what goes across the 8 episodes, I'd say, yeah, that's a lot to squeeze into 8 episodes. But they've a lot in the first episode, and you certainly need to have your wits about you to keep a track of everybody. However, in episode 2,
yes,
in comes
Meryl. In comes Meryl playing a whale. which I wasn't expecting. In episode two, we slow down a little bit and we take... It's going to be interesting, Sean, because the first episode, the episodes are named after the year in which they're set. The first one's 2037, 2046, 2047. We go all the way up to 2070. We won't go there today. Yeah. But in 2046, in the second episode, we have Sienna Miller's zoologist character. She's working for this company that is trying to preserve endangered species. We're living in a world now where tigers are extinct, where the last humpback whale is being studied and monitored by the zoologist. Elephants are extinct. But to kind of get a sense of what this humpback whale needs to survive, her company, Sienna Miller's company, Rebecca Shearer is a character's name, they've developed communication that allows them to literally hold conversations with whales. And they shouldn't be applying human voices to the whale's sounds, basically. I hope I'm making sense here. But this character has, and she's actually put the voice of her late mother into the system that allows them to communicate with whales. So basically, Sienna Miller's talking to a humpback whale, voiced by Meryl Streep.
Tell me about the end.
The end? Where does the circle end? It is always now ending, and now beginning. We rise and fall on our breath for as long as the world allows. The days press against us and then move past. Now becomes next until we fall away and return what has been taken. Is that what you wanted to know?
I want to know everything.
That's the voice of Meryl Streep there as Eve, the mother of Rebecca, played by Sienna Miller in episode two of Extrapolations, a new series from Apple TV Plus that Chris Wasser has been watching. As I listen to that now, Chris, I admit in isolation, I did find episode one hard to follow in terms of it was all in several locations and lots of new characters being introduced all the time, which is always a problem with the first episode. But Meryl sounds quite poetic.
It sounds poetic at first, and then after half an hour, it sounds like Meryl Streep reciting, you know, dialogue that's been written by an AI essay writer. Yeah. It gets a little bit annoying, and it's a little bit wasteful, I think.
Is
to
it
have.
That bad, do you think?
It is a little bit bad because it starts to get quite preachy, and you know, you're very much aware that you're watching Sienna Miller communicate with this CGI whale, and it's a little bit soulless. It's not real. And one of the unique selling point of this series is that Scott C. Burns is supposed to be designing this parable set in a world that we can relate to, but we can't. The technology that we're looking at in this story, it's just so far-fetched that it's just that's not our world. And we do see Meryl. I should say we do see Meryl in home recordings because Meryl's character is the zoologist mother, as I said, and she recorded all of these bedtime stories that Rebecca could read to her son. But again,
that's handy that she did that, isn't it?
But it's Meryl Streep on a television in a television show. What are you doing? This is one of the greatest actresses that's ever lived. It's a waste.
Because I was looking at, you know, the first episode, as you said, set in 2037. The second episode set in 2070. So somebody who's in 30 in the first episode is going to be in their 60s somewhere in the final episode. So characters aren't going to last the entire time unless, of course, technology is going to make that possible.
Unless technology might make that possible. And some of the technological advances here, I would not be surprised. I'm not spoiling anything here because, you know, at one stage, in the third episode, which is actually my favourite, we concentrate on the rabbi that I mentioned who has taken up a job working in a synagogue in Miami. And Miami at this stage, large parts of it are actually underwater. And he's struggling to kind of get the government funds to save his synagogue. And that's a very human story. And there's an awful lot of charm in it. There's an awful lot of wit that David Schwimmer, that David Diggins, that the great Jude Hirsch brings to the table. I enjoyed that one a lot more than the whale. But some of the advances that the humanity is said to have made while the planet is burning just doesn't make any sense. Mm. We're said to, in, you know, just over the course of 25 years, we're supposed to have gone to Mars. We're supposed to have cured cancer. We're all war and conflict is at an end. That that's not going to happen.
Well, going to Mars and curing cancer, we might have hopes for those, but conflict being at an end, that's not going to happen.
It's too outside of the reach. But yeah, so I think the first episode is bloated, but it's a starting point and it's an introduction to the characters. The second one is kind of feels like...
But you stuck with it to episode three, and was it worth it?
That's true, because the second one kind of feels like this very kind of timid Black Mirror sort of setup. But the third one was a compelling human drama. So if I'm to stick with it, and I just can't see an awful lot of people getting past that second episode, if I'm to stick with it, that's more of what I want to see. I want to see more of that human drama.
Is your suggestion to people, don't give up until episode three?
Don't give up. Wait until episode three before you make a decision. And all three episodes are actually, those first three episodes are actually going to be out this week.
Right.
And then the remaining ones will be out on a weekly, week by week basis.
All right. So give it a go.
Yeah, give it a go. Yeah.
But be prepared to be a bit annoyed in one and two.
Be prepared for the whale.
Be ready for the whale.
Yeah.
Chris Wasser speaking to us about Extrapolations. First three episodes, as he said, premiere this Friday, March the 17th, if you're doing nothing else, on Apple TV+. The remaining five episodes will roll out on a weekly basis.